This is a download from the BBC. This edition of The Bottom Line, Radio 4's business discussion programme, was first broadcast on the 14th of October 2010. Here's Evan Davis.
Hello and welcome to The Bottom Line. Now, to many, logistics is just a fancy word to describe the activity of driving a lorry. And of course it is, but it's so much more as well. Organising those lorries and what's in them is one of the most sophisticated activities of a modern business. We'll be finding out what it consists of. And today we'll also talk about customer service. How high should a company aim at satisfying each and every client? But before we do that, let's spend a few minutes meeting each of my three guests. And first, Tim Steiner, who's the co-founder and chief executive of the online supermarket Ocado. Welcome, Tim. We're going to discuss your operation, obviously, when we talk about logistics in a minute. But just give us a sense of the scale of the number of items you deliver.
On a busy day now, we'll deliver just over 1.05 million items to about 19,500 customers.
Now, a lot of people had tried this before Ocado came along, right? I mean,
sure.
Famously, there was Webvan in the United States, one of the early dot-com pioneers, built a huge warehouse, never got it off the ground. What made you think you could make a grocery business online?
The grocery market is enormous. It's nearly £150 billion in the UK. And so a lot of the early online pioneers were building businesses that needed 90% of the market to move online. They needed to have a first mover advantage, as they talked about, and get 80% market share. Whereas, you know, today we have about 0.33% of the UK grocery market.
What, a third of 1%?
A third of 1%. And yet, you know, the analysts will forecast that our sales this year, which will close out in about 8 weeks, will be about 550 million. So you can be a very big company with a very small market share in groceries. So we thought that was fascinating. And really what we believed was that there was an opportunity to apply technology and very smart logistics to enable a massively increased customer service and a much better service for customers, but that we could take a lot of costs out of the existing distribution chain.
I mean, one of the great questions that sort of hangs over the business is, I mean, you're in certain important respects still a startup, aren't you? I mean, you're not turning a profit yet.
Yeah, so we haven't, in any of the announcements we put out, announced any profitability. The last 2 years, we've been seeing increasing levels of EBITDA profitability. So that's earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. So really the key ones for us would be before depreciation and before interest costs. And we've seen that finally go positive in 2008 at 2 million, in 2009 go to 9 million. And I think the forecasts, the average analyst forecast out there for us for this year is to get it to 20-ish. But next year, they're all forecasting that we will be profitable. Obviously, that's not something that I'm allowed to forecast, but the analysts are suggesting that we will finally show that you can be an independent online grocery business and be profitable next year.
All right. Well, also with us is Nick Wilson, who's the managing director of the UK arm of Hewlett-Packard, the American IT giant. And Nick, I suppose most people know you as a company that makes printers these days.
One part of what we do is make printers, which hopefully lots of people have on their desk. But over the last 3-4 years, we've acquired over 40 companies. So Palm Pilot, 3Com, a company called EDS, who are one of the largest service providers in the globe. So we've become the number one technology company in the world. And PCs and printers probably, you know, for the UK doesn't account for more than, you know, 30% of what we do. So
where are you in the PC market in the UK?
Number one.
Number one. So now you're actually doing an enormous amount of providing a lot of service as well as a lot of manufactured goods. Do you have any manufacturing operations on your watch?
I have one. I have one in Ireland where we have about 2,000 folk in a factory that make print cartridges. So we have two centres for making print cartridges, one in Asia and one in Ireland.
It's obviously been a difficult few years globally for the economy. You've just created a lot of jobs or announced the creation of jobs in Scotland. You have also relatively recently announced 1,300 job losses, yep, in the UK too. What's going on that you're growing some places, cutting in others?
A lot of it's around rebalancing where our workload is and how we go after things. So customers are trying to save money. So if a customer wants to save 25-30% a year, the government wanting to do those sort of things as well, then you've got to look at where's the best place to operate your best cost resource. It is really hard to work through, but if we want to provide the best service to our customers at the rates they're asking for in a market which is increasingly cost competitive, where people want a lot more for less money, you have to look at where you place your work. There's a tricky balance between the two.
So it's cutting jobs in the south, around Bristol, is it?
No, it's not been specified where. We're actually in the early stages of consultation of what's the best place to do it and how to do it. So we'll work through that over the next period of 90 days with the works councils and the unions and the employees of where we would consult to do the work.
All right, thank you. Well, my third guest is Ian Mason, who's the chief executive of a FTSE 250 company called Electro Components. It has been described as the biggest company you've never heard of. I think, why don't you just tell us what you do?
Well, we have sales of about £1 billion. That comes from 1.5 million customers around the world. We serve 27 countries around the world, so it's very much a global business. Those customers are electronic design engineers, design the next new product, or maintenance engineers fixing things. And what they want is a very broad range of products. We have 500,000 products in stock. They want them all available, and they want them delivered reliably.
I mean, what is a typical thing that you sell?
Well, in electronics, there'll be semiconductors. If you think of a printed circuit board, everything on there, including the board, we will sell. The box it will go into, the connectors, going out to the cables, the physical things it connects to, switches, relays.
I mean, one of the things your company is famous for is starting from scratch every morning. I mean, just explain what this is about.
Yeah, you know, the nature of the demand is you decide what you're working on tomorrow. You say, what will I need tomorrow? And so we have no forward order books. So they then come on the phone or come on the web and order from us. So we ship 40,000 orders a day. That'll be about 80,000 products a day around the world.
And then tomorrow it's another 40,000.
It starts again. So, you know, we have what you call immediate hindsight. I can tell you around the world what's just happened. Unfortunately, I can't tell you what's going to happen.
So it must be quite scary. I suppose it's just extremely unlikely that the phone would stop.
Well, you hope not. Yeah. it's a bit like a supermarket as well, you know. There's established patterns and seasonality, but you want that phone to keep ringing.
Yeah. These are small orders. It's not a big company. It's not a HP, Hewlett-Packard ordering a sort of a huge wadge of stuff. It is sort of little pieces.
Our sales are £1 billion. That's not too shabby. The average order value is £100.
£100.
We've got 1.5 million customers. So what the customers have to be doing, they have to be ordering very frequently.
And you've built up a business with £1 billion worth of sales.
The business actually, no one's heard of Electro. It was actually with Traders RS, which started in 1937. As radio spares. That's where the RS is. So we've been in business since 1937, and we started in a garage in London. So a bit like HP, we started in a garage. Yeah. So the model's been around for a while.
Well, perhaps that brings us on to the subject of logistics, because anyone listening to these three descriptions of your businesses would be able to tell why we thought logistics would be a good topic to talk about today. I mean, military leaders have long understood the importance of it. Rommel, the military leader of the German Second World War effort, said, before the fighting proper, the battle is won or lost by the quartermasters. Tim, why don't you describe to us your operation in Hatfield? Because the logistics just seems, as one who's been able to have a look around that facility, it is incredibly complicated.
We're picking for 19 up to 19,500 customers, and each of them actually takes about 55 items on average. And those items are coming both from the ambient section of the warehouse, the fridge, and the freezer. And we've got to pick them, and we've got to get all the right combination together in one place. And then we've got to merge that customer's order, which is normally four or five boxes, together with another 16 or 17 customers to put them all on one vehicle that's then going to go around and deliver them to those customers' houses. And the food has got to remain at the right temperature all the way to the customer's door.
It's incredibly automated, though, as well, isn't it? I mean, you do have people who are loading stuff into bags. That was the bit you couldn't entirely automate. But, I mean, they're given instructions by machines constantly about which item is going into this bag.
Yes, the actual act of picking an individual item of grocery for a customer at the moment is all done by human, because it's very hard to get a machine that could pick a bunch of grapes and that could also pitch a bunch of cornflakes and a six-pack of Evian. So you've got to take into account the size, the shape, the crushability. But our machinery, as you saw, is moving the products from the dock and storing them and presenting them to the pickers, and then it's moving the customer orders around between different pickers, who are then instructed in very clear and easy kind of user interfaces as to what they should do for the customers, that enables them to be very fast and very accurate.
You can get carried away with automation and logistics, think you should automate everything. We do a lot of automation depending on the size of the warehouse, but there's been some cases where we've perhaps gone too far.
Really?
With automation. There's just so much more flexibility, and especially with demand changes, the size of products change, you want to move them around, and a person is just a very flexible resource.
But I really thought there had been something of a revolution in this area, though, over the last 15 years, because I mean, it's true at Ocado, I'm sure it's true at Electro Components. The ability to track, to monitor, to use scanning and barcodes to see where things are and to optimise the position of these things is, I mean, it takes a lot of computer power.
The real sexiest, I think, is in the software and the systems and the people. You know, I think historically logistics was guided by looking through the rearview mirror. What has happened, what's happened before, use that as a predictor to the future. Now we spend a lot of time looking to the future, trying to predict demand much better. And that's where, you know, e-commerce, you can actually sense demand. You can get a much better feel of what might be happening in the future.
How do you mean you can get a sense of it?
We produce a catalogue. And when you send that catalogue out, that's it, it's gone. Now half of our sales are over the web. You can watch customers through the software about what they're looking at. You can look at the points in time of when you looked like they were going to buy, but they didn't buy. And you can say, well, was that when they checked the price? Was that when they checked the amount of stock? Were they searching for something that you didn't have, a different stock number? You know, the holy grail of logistics is true lost demand. What could you have served but didn't?
Our issue's a lot different with 42 companies bought, lots of people coming into the company. Our supply chain globally is about $50 billion, where we ship a PC every 2 seconds and a printer every 2 seconds. The contrast we had is we had thousands of processors, thousands of depots. We would have two vans arrive at one plane, one going off to the printer place, one going off to the PC place, and they'd be 300 yards apart,
right?
Believe it or not. So a lot of what we've done in the last 2 or 3 years is simplify, rationalise the processors, and we've tried to use our corporate scale for buying. I mean,
makes sense.
The power supply, really simple, silly examples that you put in a PC, isn't that different to a printer, isn't that different to a server. And we used to buy them separately via 10 different contracts in 10 different locations in 10 different countries. Just simply rationalising that to buying one power supply from one supplier saved us $35 million. Mm-hmm. So we've picked best practice and installed it once, not 10 different ways.
We're smaller than you are, obviously, but we've built the processes up over time. But it doesn't mean that because we started with a blank sheet that the first process you put in is wonderful, because we're in our warehouse, we're probably in our fourth version of the processes and systems. And we're constantly developing. So one of our kind of philosophies is to constantly improve.
Yeah.
And we're currently working on new algorithms in our packing, for example, where we already direct the people what products to put with what other products. So a bag isn't random at Ocado. You'll never tell a picker to put a mango in the same bag as a can. But actually, we discovered that, believe it or not, there's 1E to the 35. So there's one with 35 zeros after it, different ways that you can pack an average customer's grocery shopping. And we're currently working on trying to make that the most efficient,
you know,
best way.
Logistics is a well-established discipline. You know, there's operations as part of it, the picking, packing, the warehouse, the supply chain negotiation of transport. Inventory controllers, very skilled people. You know, we have 250 of them.
And they're controlling the stocks and what you have of each different item. So one of the great dilemmas is whether to hold stock, which is a cost, or whether to order in.
Well, our business model is we hold it. So once it's in the offer, that's we bring it in and hold it in stock. Increasingly with the internet, what we've been able to do is we can bring stock in, we can offer it around the world through the web, without bringing it into the full system of the catalogue, etc., and see if it sells. And then that gives you a much better sense of what will sell and what will not, because with all product management, you know, picking which products will really take off and which not is more of an art than science.
But we have a much harder problem on this one than Ian does, because our products go off.
Yeah.
Okay, and so our aim is to hold them for the absolute minimum amount of time before we get them to the customer, because you don't want to think we've got lots of tuna steaks sitting there and we'll deliver one of them to you. You want it to have arrived in our warehouse, you know, an hour before we start shipping it to you. And so we have to manage a very, very fast stock turnover.
But why don't you then hold loads? If he can do it, you can do it, and then you won't be holding all that.
It's a different demand, you see. It's a different demand. What the engineer buys today will be different tomorrow, will be different day after. So it's not like selling bread, bananas, that you buy the staples all of the time.
Your task, Nick, in the manufacturing side is sort of the other end of it. You've got not only to ship the stuff out in an efficient way, you've got to get the stuff in an efficient way.
The components to put it all together. We spend a massive amount of time looking at forecasts, because you build your manufacturing capability and your component buying against what your salesman's forecasts are. So that's an enormously difficult task, because, you know, when the market slumped in 2009, we really cramped down manufacturing based on the market a lot. In the early half of this year, we found the product demand in the market did return quite significantly.
And you were caught short?
A little bit for a while. There was a 2 or 3 month lag, because we had shut down such a lot, because we didn't want to hold too much stock. We wanted enough turning it back up really quickly, you know, is a bit of a challenge.
You can look at the back end, but actually so much of the value is actually in the forecast.
Absolutely.
And getting salespeople to give a forecast, a bad forecast is better than no forecast, because you can then amend it. And then it's the judgments around it. You know, we've just been through a downturn where we took out 30 million of stock, and no sooner had we got it out, we had to put it all back in. The systems can't tell you that. They can't deal with that rate of change. And that's where you need smart people.
You know, we have some products like bread and milk, incredibly predictable. I could tell you to the nearest 1% how much milk will sell in, you know, 3 days' time in the afternoon. And as a result, we actually hold incredibly low inventory. And it's at the end of every trading day, we will almost have no milk in the building at all. But other items you have to hold more of because they're more volatile.
So
they're weather related, for example. Yeah. If it drops 2 degrees, you sell less bag salads and you sell more, you know, products that go into stews and things like that. And so the weather starts to influence other items.
So stock levels, the inventory level, depends to some extent on the volatility of the demand to a large degree.
Yep. Correct.
I mean, it must go wrong quite often, though, doesn't it? Tim, you must be woken in the night with horrendous things that have happened to drivers, lorries, conveyors.
Thankfully, I'm working in the night a lot less than I was several years ago. But things obviously can go wrong in any business, and ours is not immune to that. And so if we have an issue in our warehouse, our entire head office, myself included, will decamp over there and we will start picking. So we will basically boost the headcount to make sure that we always get every day's orders out.
You stand next to the shelf taking stuff off the shelf.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody will. And if actually it works quite well in the long term as well, because it means that people that are designing systems or writing software for our systems have actually used them. They've actually picked groceries.
And so how often have you had to do that?
In the last year, not very often, you know, a couple of times. But if you went back 3 or 4 years ago, we used to do it a lot.
Ian, I mean, you must have nightmares, don't you?
Systems updates usually cause a few problems, a few sleepless nights. There's always things will break, so you have to throw people at it, including myself.
Our biggest nightmare would be is actually predicting accurately the delivery date. So if a customer wants it on the 1st and you've committed the 10th and getting the right date, sometimes predicting the exact date of delivery for a client is pretty tough. But we've moved more to direct shipping. We have backups of our ships as well as planes now in case, because of the ash cloud stuff, we actually now put things on boats.
We have backup ships.
Well, we have to, because if, you know, we've now got a disaster plan for if the ash cloud occurs again. Because if you were heavily reliant on air freight, then, you know, your business is going to suffer.
Well, if I get another life, I want to come back as a logistics manager. I think it's a fascinating, fascinating business. Thank you all. Just a reminder, you're listening to The Bottom Line on BBC Radio 4. I'm Evan Davis, and this week my guests are Tim Steiner of the online supermarket Ocado, Nick Wilson of Hewlett-Packard, and Ian Mason of the electronics distributor Electro Components. Now, at this point in the programme, we like to get you all to comment on a topical news story, one of the week's stories. This was the week that Philip Green of Topshop produced a report for the British government advocating that it did more centralised purchasing. It said it could save a great deal of money by not having individual departments buying their own little thing. I'm interested in your views on this, because you were, in a way, hinting at you making savings, Nick, in your own company that way.
I think there's an awful lot of money to be saved by doing things once, with a strategy that's driven centrally. I don't think the government uses its procurement power. I mean, they have 112 data centres, for instance, in the UK. They don't need 112. I mean, we think they could get that down to around a dozen.
So that's, I think both models are right. It depends what you apply it to. Some things should be centrally procured, and there's massive savings, I think, as Nick said. Other things, I think the transaction cost of doing it and the bureaucracy just blows it out the water. For a small order, you might as well do it locally because all the costs added to it. So you need to do both.
You get the Pentagon buying a screw for $8 billion.
You could set up a central contract with local buying power.
I think there's a bigger question. How many of these reviews have there been for government? How many can you remember? There was the Gershon one before that, and there's been hundreds of them. And it always comes back to, I think it's the culture of buying. When you sell to the government, it's quite different to selling to a private organisation. Now, sometimes it should be different, but sometimes it just shouldn't be that different. You know,
but they've always been seen as a soft touch. And as Philip was saying, you know, they need to start thinking about it as though they're spending their own money. It's not their own money, but you need everybody. And we all practice that in our businesses, I'm sure. We all try and teach everybody that's spending money to think of it as their own and to always ask for that extra discount and always check another supplier and always put the person in competition. Because ultimately, what we spend on something, we have to pass on to our customer somehow.
All right, well, we're going to find out more about that over the next weeks, months and years. Before we move on, let me just remind you all that we do enjoy reading emails, comments, quips, complaints. Just drop us a line at thebottomline@bbc.co.uk.
www.bbc.co.uk. Talking of complaints, let's talk now about customer service. Here are two philosophies. First, a zero tolerance for failure. Treat every customer as far too important to upset. Second, be realistic. It's just not economic to satisfy everybody. Now, companies will always tell us they have a zero tolerance for failure. But is it really sensible to spend that much money on trying to satisfy everybody? Ian.
We aim for the first model, for perfection, to keep everyone happy, but you can't go too far. There's lots of people that know the cost of everything, the value of nothing, you know, to use that old phrase, because the costs of doing the service are very clear, they're very hard, they're very now. But the value of having somebody be able to take that phone call, the value of having your people properly trained, you can see the cost. So I think you have to have some acts of faith on customer service. So one of the things we do is we have local nationals answering the phones. We don't centralise that because we think that sensitivity and language is important. You know, half our business is through the web, so people say, why don't you just push everybody through the web? Web-only customers still occasionally call. Now, we tend to segment it. The back end that doesn't touch the customer of customer service, we really take the cost out. But that front end where you will have contact, we make sure we focus on the value, but not everybody's equal. You know, a large customer like HP will get additional services to what an SME will.
There's a degree of realism in there.
Yeah, well, there's always a degree of realism.
I'm going to look at Tim now, because you sometimes go to ludicrous expense to satisfy customers. One customer, you'll spend an enormous amount. It must just be a huge drain on the ability of the business to earn money.
I think the key is that we ship over 100,000 orders a week. And actually, to do a perfect order is the best order. It's the best economically to do it right the first time. Because if a customer wants to buy £110 and you deliver everything, you get a revenue of £110. If it arrives on time, everything's fresh and the order is perfect, they tend not to phone, so your operator doesn't need to answer the phone. You don't need to give them a refund and they're most likely to shop with you again. When occasionally a small number of those orders aren't right, your reputation is also incredibly important. And a reputation is something that's very hard to earn and very easy to lose. And so we strive very, very hard to maintain
it. But expensive to maintain. And if you're going around giving away 50 quids all the time because you accidentally screwed up in some way, you're never going to break into profitability.
And of course, the key is that if you've got to give away £25 or £50 to a customer because you've upset them that week, if you've got five customers you've done it to, it's very small in the scheme of 100,000 customers a week.
I disagree with you. I think in the Ocado model, it would have been easy to say this is a web business. It's a web business. If you've got a problem, go on the web. But when you've got a problem, you want to talk to someone. That 50 quid voucher or the bottle of wine, or the additional discount you're going to give me now, you're piling that cost against, hopefully, years of orders, years of a weekly order. You mustn't focus on the cost all the time. It's the value.
Right. Well, look, let's talk about HP, Nick, because, I mean, it is not difficult to find complaints about HP's customer service. You know, a cursory search on the web. Does anyone have Mr. Wilson's email address? I'd be delighted to tell him what I think of his ramshackle customer service. Another one, I've been trying 3 weeks to get a part replaced under its warranty. I haven't managed yet. Phone calls are all premium lines at 12p a minute. Blah, blah, blah. You get the point. What is your philosophy? Do you essentially assume that you're going to always have to have a level of discontent and it's just not economic to get rid of it?
To be honest, people can write in. I mean, I get lots of emails. On the big customer side, that's about customer surveys. How do we do better business with you? How do we dedicate
stuff? But what about
on the consumer side?
The smaller side,
We do try to satisfy every customer. Are we going to make it perfect every single time, shipping a PC every 2 seconds and a printer every 2 seconds? No. Hopefully, though, what we strive to do is fix when we get something wrong quicker and better. Do we fix it all perfectly first time? No. I have a dedicated team for escalated complaints of eight people.
Right, so that's
they
really
can write to the MD, and I make sure that I do have a look at them all. I have a weekly call with the customer services team, looking at the complaints that get escalated, etc.
But it is a common complaint of technology companies, not just HP, in fairness, that, of course, it's almost impossible to find a telephone number to call them on.
Which is deliberate, right?
I mean, there's a customer services number they can ring.
Prominent on
the website, and they actually get through to an individual that will try and help them.
But it sometimes seems like it is a revenue centre for the company as well as selling the product.
It shouldn't come across like that. It's not designed to be like that.
Short-sighted. It is short-sighted.
But is it a revenue centre? 12p
no,
a minute
it's a customer fix, the service issues, because we'd like the clients back.
Why would you have a premium phone line number on? Not a very expensive one, but a 10p a minute one type thing.
They shouldn't be. Most of our customer service lines aren't premium ones.
Right. And you've got 8 staff who sit there basically
just doing escalations and nothing else. They call them the MD complaints, which go above that. But we do have a customer services centre.
You make a huge effort, Tim, to keep everybody satisfied. You still get complaints, presumably.
Yeah, we do, but I think we do things a little bit differently. So we do aim in our call centre to try and answer the phone after the first ring, rather than some companies that leave you at least 20 in the hope that you give up and drop off.
And that was deliberate by those companies.
But that's because people aren't phoning us to cancel a subscription to a phone service or to a television service or something like that. They're phoning us because they've got a problem with a live situation normally with their order. And yeah, of course we get some complaints, and a few get escalated to me, probably, you know, less than half a dozen a week. I don't have a team of 8 dealing with it. They'll come in, and either myself or my founding partner Jason will actually respond to the customers directly.
I'm sure you all do the same, but we do independent research of our customers to see how was the customer service, how do you compare us to competitors, how do you compare us to other companies. And I think it's very important you get that independent voice. It's not just the complaints that you should listen to.
It's very difficult to ask customers for their opinions, isn't it? Because most boring customers who've just had a reasonable service will actually say absolutely nothing. I mean, I always assume when I read reviews of hotels online that the people who have left a review are disproportionately those who have a strong feeling about the hotel. It's quite natural. And at least half those who have a strong feeling will have a strong negative feeling because they were the unlucky ones who happened to be there the day the building.
You'd be surprised. We ask our customers to participate in surveys for us, and we get tens of thousands of respondents, you know, on a monthly basis that will actually tell us things. And yes, you know, if you say to a customer, you know, would you like the service to be cheaper? Obviously, they'll all tick the box that says yes. Doesn't matter how cheap you get, they'll still tick the box that says yes. But you can ask questions in a different way so you can get an understanding of how they feel about you, your service, your pricing, your ranges and everything else.
Steve Jobs of Apple famously answers some emails himself and is sometimes quite abrupt and brutal in his answers if he doesn't think a complaint is reasonable. Do you ever write a complaint saying, stop whinging, you paid 80 quid for that printer? Of course,
no, I don't do those. The only ones I get annoyed at are some members of the public get quite animated in some of their complaints and can use fairly abusive language, and that's the only thing I won't tolerate. If someone's got a genuine complaint, then I'll read all their emails, I'll make sure that they're got back to. But if someone rings up and starts abusing my secretary over the phone, then I'm afraid I have taken the phone off my secretary a couple of times and said, when you can calm down, you can ring back, because I don't think that's acceptable behaviour.
Well, we must draw a close now, but there is time to thank my 3 guests: Tim Steiner of Ocado, Nick Wilson of Hewlett-Packard, and Ian Mason of Electro Components. Remember, you can always subscribe to our podcast. To do so, just visit our website, bbc.co.uk/bottomline, and I'll be back with more guests next week. Until then, goodbye.
Evan Davis. The Bottom Line was produced by Ben Crichton. For more information, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.